everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Crime and Coffee Couple. My name's Allison.
And my name's Mike.
Hi, Mike.
Hey.
What the heck are you doing next to me?
We had to restart because he was like, oh, we got to restart. And I was like, why? You're like, you're doing something next to me. Cause, like, sometimes I could do something jerky a little bit and be like, come on, I'll finish up or whatever. I was just waving at the camera. She didn't see it. So that's all it was, just waving. Hello, everybody on YouTube.
You befuddled me.
Yeah. Hey, while we're waving, why don't you go ahead and click that subscribe button? I believe it's down here. I don't know. Like this way is a certain direction. I don't know. Just down there somewhere. If you've been on YouTube, you found it. So go ahead and just click subscribe and you'll get updated and all of our stuff. So how you doing this week, bub?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you?
Yeah, good. Just brewed a hot cup of Joe, Java coffee, if you will. And we left for our son's Little League game, my son and I, because we go early and you come, right when the game starts. And I realized I left my coffee at home. I had a nice like breakfast sandwich that I, just put in the microwave. It was ready to go. I wanted my coffee. I'm like, I didn't have to get the coffee.
It's so the worst when you're looking forward to it and then you reach down in the cup holder to grab it and it's not there.
Yep. Sitting in the garage where I left it. So, but I've got
so
it now.
Sad.
All good. So, I know we had a couple of happenstances this week that we wanted to mention on the podcast. So one of them for sure was the high school thing. We were talking at dinner, our family, and I think our kids were like, yeah, I always go number two at home. I never go number two at school. And I was like, okay, well, that makes sense. I'm like, well, I actually got very comfortable with that at my high school. And what's even weirder is, I don't know about you listeners, but in my high school, in the boys' bathroom, we didn't have any doors. Like, not even... like not front doors, like no side walls either. So, I mean, there was a wall, like you're not looking at the person next to you. There's like a wall about 3 feet high, maybe.
Okay. You couldn't see their face.
You
were literally sitting on a toilet in the open air.
About as close as we are right now. And there was a wall like here. Like about here. So
you could turn to the side and make eye contact with the person crapping next to you.
Yes. And it's about shoulder high. So if you're not watching this on video, it's high and you can turn and talk to them and smell everything that's going on over there.
Now we were in high school in the 90s. We went to high school from 1994 to 1997. And I will tell you, it was the same in the boys' bathroom at my high school. We went to neighboring high schools. And my brother would come running home through the door because he refused to go number two in the bathroom at school. And thank goodness the girls' bathroom did have stall doors because that would be horrifically traumatizing. I mean, imagine like changing a tampon. It's like, what? Yeah.
I mean, that's gross as it is. So I can only imagine people looking at you and watching. So,
and obviously that's not the case now. Like our son was like, oh yeah, of course we have stall doors. It's like, well, we didn't back in our day.
Well, what was super cool about our situation, I ended up having like two lunches senior year, which are an hour long each. And it was like 2 hours of basically nothing.
Two hours of lunch.
Yeah. It was awesome.
What a waste.
I was a football player. So like the football coaches were like, yeah, just go take study hall or whatever.
Ooh, aren't you cool? Johnny football player.
I was cool. No longer. But it was cool because my friend and I, we were both had 2 hour lunches and we both like for the first hour we took and we made sure to eat. And then the second hour we go in the bathroom and just hang out and drop a deuce.
And you pooped.
Yeah. It was kind of fun. Everybody would walk in and be like, hey, guys. And they'd be like, hey,
Pernacki, that's so Starba. Awkward. Yeah. So I guess if you're a guy and you were a child of the 90s in high school, let us know if your high school had stall doors.
Yeah. Go ahead and leave a comment wherever
you're
listening.
So interesting. And then the other thing we were going to talk about was for Mike's birthday. I know we mentioned you got the Ninja Creamy ice cream maker, and we've been making this like low calorie, high protein ice cream. It's been delicious. I picked up mix-ins, and so I'm like, oh, Mike, the best ice cream I ever had is the one I never had to make. I always say that about everything. And so Mike goes, and I told him, I'm like, if you could just put like two Oreo thins in and one brownie bite. So he makes it for me. Oh, I'm loving it. It's delicious. I'm eating it. And I finished. I was like, wow, that was good. So you put the one brownie bite in and you're like, oh, no, I put like three.
Yeah, it was a significant amount. I jam packed that thing.
It was probably more brownies than ice cream. So I should have known better, but I think I didn't want to.
You didn't
know.
Want to. You're just like, this is too good. It's I'm going to ask good. Once I'm done.
So I'm like, oh, my gosh. So I just ate like 600 calories of ice cream.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that, I mean, that can't be good.
Good news, 40 grams of protein, but still quite a significant amount of calories.
So needless to say, when I weighed myself today, I was like 2 pounds up.
She's plumping up a little bit. That's all right.
You like know? A Thanksgiving turkey.
She's getting ready for winter in November.
Yeah.
A little bit early.
November?
Well, winter It's November.
Oh, well, it's April.
I know. It's early. That was the joke.
What are you talking about? Yeah, yeah.
Folks, help me out here.
It's about 90 degrees outside today.
That's why it's funny, because it's not winter time, Allison.
So, yeah, that was a lot.
Yeah. So, we got some different things going on. But, hey, we want to thank you for listening. If you're a new listener and you love what we're doing, we have other ways to get, besides our free weekly shows every Sunday, we also have a bonus episode. Comes out every Wednesday around noonish Eastern time. And whether you're an Apple subscriber or a Patreon, you can go ahead for as little as $5 on Patreon, go ahead and become a Patreon. And I know it's tax return season, so you know, take a couple of bucks and throw them to Ma and Pa over here. I'm Pa
and I'm Ma.
Yeah.
So, and we certainly appreciate each and every one of you, so absolutely. Thank you so much for being here. And on that note, are you ready to jump in?
I am.
All right, so this, I'm almost kind of embarrassed to say, I had never heard of this case. And those that are listening might be like, what rock have you been laying under? Because I am immersed in the true crime world. If I'm not researching and recording a podcast, I'm listening to a fellow podcast. So I've never heard of this case, and I'm sure Mike has not, because he is not a true crime listener.
Yeah, I see a true crime, I shut off the TV.
Yeah, and I'm the opposite. So this is a listener suggestion from Rachel. So thank you so much, Rachel. This is the Keddy Cabin Murders, and it took place in 1981. We were only like, I was 2 years old at the time that it happened. The anniversary actually just passed for this.
You said 81?
Yes, 81. Wow. And so I don't know. Somehow I didn't hear about this. We grew up in Illinois. This happened in California. So I don't know if it was the distance or what. But regardless, it was my first time hearing about it. So please listen to the story, though, with care, because it does contain parts that are detailed information of the crime scene. I will warn you ahead of time when I'm going to be describing what the police found, but it is graphic.
All fair in a true crime podcast.
Yeah. So this is a case of a grisly quadruple murder that happened in April of 1981 at the Keddy Resort in the tiny Northern California town of Keddy, California. Many years before this horrific night, the resort was considered idyllic. It included a rustic hotel, a bar, and a restaurant. It was nestled in the woods along the Feather River.
Hey, real quick, how do you spell Keddy?
K-E-D-D-I-E.
I just, it drives me nuts if I don't know how to spell it.
So, well, and then okay. That way you could picture it too. Yeah. So again, it's nestled in the woods along the Feather River, and it was founded in 1910 as a getaway where 33 cabins were available for rental, and vacationers would fish for trout in the rivers or walk along the beautiful trails.
Sounds beautiful. Out in California, nice mm-hmm. family vacation.
Yeah. So in its heyday, the Keddy Lodge restaurant was packed with patrons who were dining on barbecued bear ribs and sherry-basted raccoon steaks.
Seriously?
That's what it said.
Wow.
So I don't know about you, Mike, but I have personally never dined on raccoon.
You know, what I say is, why don't we have more raccoon available? It's probably because raccoon doesn't taste very good.
I would imagine it's pretty dang gamey. And yeah. I'm not a big meat eater, but I don't even eat deer or anything like that. So when people say the word gamey, I know I'm out.
You're like, mm-mm-mm.
I'm like, peace.
Yeah.
So the area was once a busy railroad terminal in the Sierra Nevada mountains. But after the railway closed down, Keddy lost much of its population. So despite the fact that the town attempted to reinvent itself by becoming a camping and hiking resort area, by 1981, when this case took place, it really had turned into just a series of cabins and low-income rental housing. Within a year of this tragic case, the resort sat empty and the owners put it up for sale in 1984 for $1.8 million, but there were no interested buyers. So basically what I'm saying is it was already kind of going downhill in 1981. This tragic case just pushed it over the edge and it became desolate after that. Over the next decade, the once tranquil vacation spot slowly rotted away, and by 1995, 25 buildings were sealed off, including the main lodge that housed the hotel, as well as the 24-hour coffee shop. Nothing was ever the same after the morning of April 12th, 1981, when 14-year-old Sheila Sharp came back to her home at Cabin 28 at the Keddy Resorts. She had been spending the night at her next-door neighbor's house in Cabin 27. It literally sat nestled almost like against their cabin. It was like 15 feet away. When she entered their modest four-room cabin, it instantly became one of the most disturbing scenes in modern American crime history, which has been known as the Keddy Cabin Murders. And again, somehow I never had heard of this. So that Sunday morning, as Sheila stepped through her unlocked front door of cabin 28, it was right around 7:45 to 8 a.m. She was staying over, like I said, at her neighbor's house in cabin 27, and she was basically coming over to grab a change of clothes because the Seabolt family, where she was staying, they were going to church, and they asked Sheila if she wanted to come. So she was just innocently hopping over, and she found a bloodied horror scene. She immediately noticed her older brother, John, lying face up, covered in blood on the living room floor. The battered bodies of her mother, who is Glenna Sue Sharp. When I say Sue, her name is Glenna, but she goes by Sue, as well as her brother's friend, Dana. This is a male, Dana, were all on the living room floor. She didn't know who was there other than the fact that it was her brother, because it was such a shock to her system that she just turned and ran.
Yeah.
So what ultimately they found were that the three were bound with medical and electrical tape and had been either stabbed, strangled, or bludgeoned to death. Sheila immediately turned and ran screaming back to the neighboring cabin where she had spent the night. So the Sharp family had been living in the cabin over the past year after Sue divorced her husband and relocated from Connecticut to Northern California.
Wow, so it wasn't just a vacation place.
No,
they were living there.
They were living there.
Okay.
So Sue was born and raised in Springfield, Massachusetts, where she met her husband, James Sharp. He was a career Navy man who was stationed near Groton, Connecticut. So the relationship ultimately fell apart after they had their five children. James began sadly abusing his wife as well as his two daughters.
What a piece of garbage.
Just terrible. So Sue decided to leave James and she left with her children.
Good. Screw you, James.
So the family of six moved to California in July of 1979. They basically chose this spot because Sue's brother, Don, lived in the Claremont Trailer Park. So she chose that location. They moved there in November of 1980. They moved there first. And then in November of 1980, they moved into cabin 28 where this horrific thing happened. So this was at the Keddie Resort. So the Sharp family included 36-year-old Sue, 15-year-old John, who was also known as Johnny, 14-year-old Sheila, 12-year-old Tina, 10-year-old Rick, and 5-year-old Greg. The family appreciated their new home as it was far larger than the trailer where they had previously lived. Because obviously, a family of six, that's a lot.
Yeah.
And the cabin itself, when they moved in, it was already pretty run down, but they were still so appreciative to have more space, you know, to get comfortable. So there were two bedrooms in the main house, and the two younger boys, Rick and Greg, shared one bedroom, and then Sue and her two daughters, Sheila and Tina, shared the other one. So Johnny, who was 15, he moved into the room in the basement that could only be accessed. I always say that wrong.
Accessed.
I don't know what is wrong with me.
Lots
accessed.
Of things. That's okay.
Just that's one of them. So his room was downstairs, and the only way to get to it was to go outside. So you'd go out onto the back porch, walk down the stairs outside, and then go into his room. So they oftentimes, and of course this is 1981, people were often not locking their doors at this time anyway, but the fact that he didn't have a bathroom down there and could only have to come back up and back in the house to use the bathroom, they always had the doors unlocked. So, you know, here they are in this new area, but they were settling in the Keddie Resort. They were making friends with their neighbors and, you know, getting comfortable and settled. So on Saturday, April 11th, 1981, this is the day before Sheila's life changed forever. She, her mom, and Greg had been visiting their friends. They were at the Meeks family home. They left there at around 11:30 in the morning to pick Rick up. He was at baseball tryouts in nearby Quincy. This is the neighboring town. So along the way, they happened upon John and his friend Dana Wingate. Again, Dana is a male. So they were hitchhiking from Quincy back to Keddie. And again, early 1980s, people are hitchhiking.
And, you know, we just shared a story recently on Instagram and TikTok where there was hitchhiking involved too. And people were like, wow, I can't believe there's people openly hitchhiking.
Yep.
And that was just part of life.
That's how people got around. So, you know, obviously they were hitchhiking, but they're passing them. So they picked them up and drove them the 6 miles back into town. And then 2 hours later at about 3:30, John and Dana hitchhiked back to Quincy so that they could visit friends. And they were seen in the downtown area right around this time. So later that evening, Sheila headed over to cabin 27, which sat adjacent to their own home. And I, like I said, I saw photos of the location. This cabin was super, super close to theirs. So she was having a sleepover with the Seabolt family. And this family included James Sr., his wife, Zanita, and then their children, who is Alyssa, Paula, and James Jr. So when Sheila left her home shortly after 8 p.m. to head over to the Seabolt cabin, her 12-year-old sister, Tina, was already there. She was hanging out and just watching TV. At 9:30 p.m., Tina headed back home where her mom, her two younger brothers, and one of the neighbor boys, Justin Eason, were. So when Sheila came across the gruesome scene the next morning upon returning home, she ran immediately back to the Seabolt's house. Now, there's conflicting information on who went back to the cabin. A few articles said that it was the Seabolt's father. Some said it was the older brother. But regardless, they went over there and found Sheila's two younger brothers, Rick and Greg, along with their friend, the 12-year-old neighbor, who is Justin. They were in the front bedroom of the cabin. They were completely unharmed. They apparently had slept through the entire massacre that had literally taken place only a handful of feet from their bedroom. Holy I saw cow. The layout of the cabin on paper. It is literally immediately off the living room.
Wow.
So how they managed to sleep through, I don't know, but I will give you more information on that. So at 8:05 a.m., the sheriff's dispatch received a phone call from the co-owner of the Keddie Resort, Jane Albin, who reported the possibility of a homicide in cabin 28 after someone from the Seabolt family ran to the lodge to report the crime, since the Seabolts did not have a phone in their cabin. When this was happening, either the father or the older brother of the Seabolt family went over to cabin 28 and helped the three unharmed boys crawl out of the bedroom window so that they did not have to pass through the living room and see this horrific, bloody massacre.
Oh, that's nice.
Jamie later admitted to briefly entering the home through the back door in order to see if he could save anyone else that might be alive. And then police later said that this could have possibly contaminated the crime scene. So there was initially confusion about who the victims were inside. Initially, there was a belief that it was Sue and two of her children. Sue's brother Don arrived after Sheila had called her uncle. He was there to identify the bodies after they were removed from the home. He said it was Sue and then her son John, and then a third person that he did not recognize. This was John's friend Dana. So Deputy Hank Clement was the first to arrive at the scene. He found the three bodies lying on the green carpeted living room immediately upon opening the door. It's like what you first see. So blood was everywhere, including the bottom of the soles of one of the boys' shoes, as well as Sue's bare feet, which indicated that they were mobile and stepped in it at some point.
Trying to get away or whatever mm-hmm. might have been the fight.
And when I say blood was everywhere, it was everywhere. It was on the walls, the ceiling, the furniture, the doors, the bedding in the girl's room, the furniture, as well as the back of the exterior steps.
Wow. So this was just a gruesome scene.
Yeah. And unfortunately, I saw a lot of the pictures of the crime scene, and it was just horrific. The blood spatter evidence indicated that the murders had mainly taken place in the living room. The large extent of blood that was pooled on the living room floor and on the sofa pillows told investigators that the victims had been moved post-mortem and positioned in the way that they were ultimately found. 15-year-old John, and I'm giving you a fair warning right now, this is where I'm going to describe what was found in the crime scene. So if you do want to skip ahead, I totally understand.
Would you say a minute, 2 minutes?
Probably two. So 15-year-old John was closest to the front door. He was lying on his back. His blood-soaked hands were bound with medical tape, and his throat had been slit. He had suffered blunt force injury to his head. A bent and bloodied steak knife laid on the floor by John's body. Dana was on the floor next to John, and he was laying face down. Blood surrounded the heads and necks of both John and Dana, which was staining the carpet around them. Dana's skull had been bludgeoned by a blunt object and his head partially rested on a pillow. He also had been manually strangled. His ankles were bound together with electrical wire, which were also connected and wrapped around John's ankles. There was no sign of defensive wounds on John or Dana's arms, which indicated that they didn't even have the chance to fight back at all. And all of their injuries appeared to happen after they had been tied up. No blood was found under the bindings. Mm. So it sounds like they were first tied up and then murdered.
Interesting.
So Sheila's mother, who is Sue, she was found partially covered by a yellow blanket, though the horrific injuries that she sustained were very apparent. The mother of five was naked from the waist down. She was lying on her side near the sofa with her hands and feet bound by electrical wiring. Reports indicate that there was no sign of sexual assault.
So that's the first thing you think about. Mm-hmm. Naked from the waist down, but no signs.
Well, one thing is that her mouth had been tightly gagged with a blue bandana as well as her own underwear. So she was wearing a robe. I don't know if they just took her underwear to use as a gag. So then they took these gags and secured them with medical tape. She had defensive wounds as well as an imprint of the butt of an 0.880 pellet gun on the side of her head, just like her son, and her throat had also been slit.
And the weird thing, electrical wiring, like not electrical tape, but
they got it from in the home, it sounds like.
So he just, whoever it was looking around and just found it.
Okay. Yes. In the process, her larynx or her voice box, that's the other word for it, had been slashed and her spine had been nicked and she had been stabbed in the chest. Each victim had suffered blunt force trauma from a hammer and sustained multiple stab wounds. In addition to the bent steak knife that they found on the floor near John's body, they also found a butcher knife and a claw hammer, which were coated in blood and sat side by side on a small wooden table near the entrance of the kitchen. Whoever had done this was likely covered in blood as they left the crime scene. It was a truly horrific sight.
Yeah, I mean, it should be easy to track, hopefully, but we're in 1981.
Mm-hmm. So autopsies determined that Sue and John died from the knife wounds and blunt force trauma, whereas Dana had died by asphyxiation. Police were so busy combing through the bloodied crime scene that it took them several hours until they realized that a fourth victim was not there. 12-year-old Tina was not in the home.
So how do they know she's a victim?
Because she's gone. So whoever did this likely abducted her was their first belief. Okay. So because she was underage, this prompted the FBI to arrive on scene.
Awesome. Well, so, good that, you know, you got bigger fish in the ballgame here.
So word of the horrific murders quickly spread through not only Keddie, but also neighboring Quincy. Residents quickly became suspicious of each other and began locking their doors at night, which again was something that they really had never done before.
You don't know who it is. It's probably somebody that lives there.
You would assume so.
A lot of finger pointing and just like, I don't know who it is, but nobody wants to talk to each other just in case they get bludgeoned.
And again, Keddie is a very small town. It's one road leads to it, one road leads away.
Odds are everybody knows the killer.
Yes.
Whoever that may be.
So, you know, people were very scared and they felt little reassurance from the sheriff's office that they were doing everything possible to catch the killers.
Why?
I'll tell you all about it.
I'm sure.
So Sheriff Doug Thomas and his deputy, Lieutenant Don Stoy, were initially unable to figure out a motive for the murders. It appeared that they were just a random horrific act. So during the interview with the Sacramento Bee, Lieutenant Stoy made the comment that a murder without a motive is normally the toughest to solve. He said, if you don't have a why to start with, it's difficult to determine the who. So Sue was remembered as a private person who kept to herself. She tried to get by like so many other people. She was a very petite woman, and those that knew her liked her very much. In the 18 months since Sue had relocated to California, she had dated maybe three men. None of the relationships were serious. Amidst raising her five children, Sue was said to receive no financial support from her ex, James Sharp, who is the father of her children.
And an abusing piece of garbage.
Yes. So she obviously, I mean, I can't even imagine raising five children on my own. This woman is a superhero in my eyes.
Yep.
So she supplemented her small income from the Navy with food stamps and a part-time job at the Quincy Elks Lodge. She also enrolled in the California Education Training Act program, which provided a small stipend. And as part of the program, she participated in a typing class at the Feather River College. The Sharps were paying $175 a month for their four-room cabin, and Sue is described as an excellent mother who was always sure that her children were well cared for, even if it meant that she had to sacrifice her own comfort. Sheila later said that despite the fact that they were living in relative poverty, they lived in a house of love.
That's really the most important thing. Mm-hmm,
totally.
You know, as long as you have a roof over your head and somewhere to put your head down and you have respect and love for each other.
And I think they were just so happy to be away from their abusive dad that, you know, they didn't care.
Yeah.
So John Sharp and his friend Dana had previously had a couple of run-ins with the police. Again, they're 15 and 17. They one time broke into a house to steal marijuana. And Dana was out on probation at the time. Because at this point in time, police are trying to figure out who could have done this. Like, did they piss somebody off? So that's why I'm talking about this.
Well, the marijuana at that time, they could think, you know, makes people go crazy. We don't know what they're capable of. You know,
psychedelic.
Yeah, exactly.
Johnny was considered a typical cocky teenager who at times had his share of arguments with other kids. He did have a leadership personality. Dana was known to be small in stature for his age. He was immature at times, but very likable. He was laid back and pleasant to be around. At the time of his murder, he was living in a group home in Quincy. Dana was a typical high school kid who liked to socialize and go to parties. He had various girlfriends. His closest friend was Johnny, and they could often be found hanging out together. Other than the fact that he was living in a foster home, he had an ordinary teenage life. When police checked with Dana's group home, they did verify that Dana had permission to be visiting and staying the night with Johnny. The last time that Johnny and Dana had been seen alive was on the corner of Lawrence Street and Highway 70, where they were seen hitchhiking back toward Keddie at 10:15 p.m., on the night of the murders, because obviously they're trying to establish a time frame for when this horrific thing happened. When Tina came home, it was about 9:30 p.m. She watched TV for a little while, and by the time police came to the house the next morning, she was missing, and no witnesses ever saw her alive again. Tina, like her mom, was also described as a private person. She would find secret hiding places when she just wanted alone time. She did require a little extra attention at school, but this made a world of a difference and helped improve her classwork. She was an average 12-year-old little girl. She had chores after school. She had a small group of friends because, of course, they're newer to this area. So, you know, they're finding their way.
Yeah.
So the blood evidence told investigators that a major struggle had ensued in cabin 28. The doors were found ajar. The furniture had been knocked over. The phone was off the hook. More than 200 pieces of evidence were removed from the home, some possibly belonging to the murderer or murderers. Police wondered if perhaps John and Dana had hitchhiked home and someone, you know, maybe the person who drove them had some responsibility of this.
Yeah, anybody connected.
Yeah. So they're speculating all avenues at this point, starting at square one. So they wondered if this person was perhaps under the influence of drugs. Based on the sheer violence of the murders, the fact that three people needed to be subdued, as well as Tina being abducted, made police believe that the killer or killers were male. It's very likely that there
Way to go, guys. Wow. That's really, really good police work, being that like 99% of these things are male.
It's true. So it's very likely that there were more than one, there was more than one killer based on the fact that there were multiple victims involved. Because if there was one person, how could you be attacking, say, Sue, and then Dana and John don't get away or overtake this person?
Yeah.
So their thought process was that there was more than one person involved in this.
I'm thinking one, but we'll see.
As well as the fact that multiple weapons were used.
Okay.
Again, there was a hammer and there were several knives, at least two knives. So the home did not show any signs of forced entry. And again, they often did leave the doors unlocked.
I'm thinking after he bent the steak knife that he just went for that chopping knife or whatever, butcher knife that you said. So I can still see one person, but we'll see.
You think one person could overtake three victims and remove Tina from the house?
Yes.
Okay. So again, there's no sign of forced entry, but detectives did recover an unidentifiable fingerprint from the handrail on the back stairs. All of the drapes had been closed and the lights had been turned off. Police could not understand how the boys, who were in the bedroom, literally right off the living room, had not heard a thing and slept through the massacre, despite the fact that a woman and her boyfriend, who lived in nearby cabin 16, woke up at about 1:30 in the morning to the sound of muffled screams. Mm. So they couldn't understand if somebody, you know, away in a distance could hear a muffled scream. How did these three boys possibly sleep through this chaos? Because again, we're talking about furniture being knocked over.
Yeah, I mean, big time heavy murders, bludgeoning, yes. People screaming. I'm sure it was mass chaos.
So, you know, they're just kind of trying to figure out how even the Seabolt family hadn't heard this, because again, they're about 15 feet away from this cabin. Mm. They hadn't heard a thing. So the three boys initially claimed that they slept through the murders, but Rick and Greg's friend Justin was later questioned under hypnosis. He said he woke up to sounds coming from the living room and got up to investigate. He said he saw Sue with two men in the house that night. One had a mustache and long hair, while the other was clean shaven and had short hair. The men were described as being in their late 20s to early 30s. One was about 5'11" to 6'2" with dark blonde hair. The other was between 5'6" to 5'10" with black greased hair. Both wore gold framed sunglasses. He said that one man had a hammer. Justin told police that when John and Dana came home, they began to argue with the men, which led to a violent fight. He explained that Tina was taken out of the cabin through the back door, and they did see that fingerprint on the banister of the stairs on the outside of the house. I believe it was with blood. So it would have made sense that Tina was taken away in that way.
Unbelievable. They could bring this out of him with hypnosis.
However, Justin's stories had been conflicting. At one point, he even said that he could have dreamed the details of the murders.
Sure.
As Justin provided his descriptions, composite sketches were produced of these two unknown men by a man who sometimes volunteered to help local police. Hmm. This man had no artistic ability and no training in forensic sketching. No explanation was ever given as to why this man was chosen, despite the fact that they had access to the Justice Department's as well as the FBI's top forensic artists.
Okay.
That's like choosing me.
It's like, you know
to
what?
Do this sketch.
Man, I feel like I'm going to help out, and I'm going to sketch it out. So what kind of eyes? Does this look right? Okay.
Like, you would never ask me.
Mine would just be a guy smiling on this, like,
exactly.
Hello.
And they'd be like, no, that doesn't look anything like the guy.
Mine would look like Butthead from Beavis and Butthead,
basically. I just found that very, very bizarre. And I will post these composite sketches on our Instagram page.
Hey, guys. We'll be right back after this ad break. It's spring cleaning time, and there's a product called Smart Labels that your future self is going to love you for getting. Here's how it works. You buy the Smart Labels QR code labels on Amazon and stick them on your storage bins. Download the Smart Labels app, scan the QR code, and catalog all the stuff going into the bin with a name, description, and picture. Then, months down the road, when you're looking for that thing you know you stored somewhere, you can just search in the app and it'll tell you where you put it. Seriously, people are calling it organizing magic. So if you're doing some spring cleaning, getting ready for a summer move, or just wanting to get organized, you need to check out Smart Labels. Just do a search on Amazon for Smart Labels, one word, and get started with your Smart Labels pack today.
So during his hypnosis, Justin also described the evening and said that Sheila and Tina had been at the Seabolt's house. Tina came back at about 7:30 p.m. She washed some dishes, and then she went back to their house and then ultimately came back to cabin 28 for the night at about 9:30 p.m. She did watch a little TV and then ultimately went to bed. Justin, Ricky, and Sue were watching TV. They were watching The Love Boat on TV, and then they went to bed at around 10 p.m. During another session, Justin spoke of Tina and said that she went into the living room after she heard noises. She was carrying a blanket. A man grabbed her and carried her down the back stairs. The man came back. He removed a hunting knife that had been stuck into one of the walls, and there were knife marks in the walls. And then he picked up Tina's blanket and left again. So this is what Justin is saying under hypnosis.
Wow. I mean, yeah, it could all be garbage. So who knows?
Despite the evidence that police recovered from the home, DNA testing was not yet available, so very little information of use was found. Collection and processing at crime scenes didn't even begin until 1984, which was about 4 years later. So, you know, that's obviously a big setback. Sheriff Thomas called the Sacramento Department of Justice, which then sent in two special agents from their organized crime unit instead of a homicide unit. And this struck many people as very strange.
Yeah, like he called the wrong number or something. And then they showed up. He's like, oh, yeah. So anyways, here it is.
As well as this guy who's sketching on his notebook who has no artistic skills.
We have local man who sometimes helps police. He's our expert sketch person. So his name's Bill or whatever the hell his name was.
Exactly.
Okay, what kind of training do you have, Bill? I just hang around the police department mostly.
And I pour coffee. I make coffee. Yeah. I grind the beans for the coffee. Okay, so where'd you go to art school? Oh, no, I didn't.
Surely you're an officer?
Mm-mm.
Nope, I just do stuff.
Yeah, so very strange choices thus far. So two immediate suspects were Martin or Marty Smart and his house guest, John Beau Bobaday, which I think is such a fun name to say. Marty just so happened to be Justin Eason's stepfather. Justin is the boy that was spending the night with Rick and Greg that was literally sleeping right off the living room. Mm. He is the one that was put under hypnosis and provided this information that this, you know, Bob the sketch artist did. So he was in his early 30s at the time, Marty. Beau, who is his house guest, who just also happens to be an ex-convict who was known to have connections to organized crime in the area, was in his 50s.
Maybe that's why organized crime is called.
Yeah, perhaps. So Justin, who again had spent the night at the Sharp home, had been living in Keddy since November of 1980 after he moved from Montana, where he was living with his dad, in order to live with his mom, Marilyn, and his stepdad, Marty. The family lived a short distance from cabin 28. They lived in cabin 26, which also included his brother. Marty was brought to Keddy to work as a new cook in the restaurant at the local hotel. However, I did read that he had just lost his job before the murders happened. Beau started living in cabin 26, maybe 10 days before the murders. He had been sleeping on the couch in the cabin 26 living room.
As Marty's special friend.
As his friend.
This is Daddy's friend. He's going to be staying with us. And he's just out of jail, so everything's safe.
Everything's good. So on the Saturday night of the murders, Marilyn, Marty, and Beau were at the Keddy Backdoor Bar. On their way to the bar, they were said to have stopped by Cabin 28. They asked Sue if she wanted to join them, but she declined. Marty became angered when they were hanging out at the bar because he did not like it when the music was changed from country to rock. So he up and left, and the three of them went home.
Marty didn't like the backdoor bar?
He did not appreciate the fact that country was no longer playing.
At the backdoor bar?
At the backdoor bar.
Okay.
Yes. So they went back to Cabin 26, and once back, Marilyn just stayed there. She was watching TV and then ultimately went to bed. Marty picked up the phone. He called the bartender, complained about the music, and then Marty and Beau left shortly after to return to the bar for one last drink, where they stayed until about closing time, which would have been about 2 a.m. Witnesses said that Marty and Beau were dressed very strangely. Now, we're talking about a tiny, tiny mountain town in the woods of California called the Backdoor Bar.
Yep.
Mike, stop saying that.
I have to say it. I have to. Like, I can't sit here and not talk about
and
the Backdoor Bar.
Do you want to know how...
with Marty and Bo.
You want to know how, what's the word, like, dense I am?
You didn't pick up on it?
I did not pick up on that at first.
Okay.
When you kept saying the Backdoor Bar.
Let me put it together.
Bar.
Marty and his special friend, Bo, who are dressed extravagantly, apparently you're about to tell me, were at the Backdoor Bar for one last drink. So there's a lot of things going on here, but go ahead.
I'm very naive and innocent, I guess.
Yep.
So they were dressed very strangely. And all I want to say is this is a very laid back establishment. People are probably drinking, you know, beer out of bottles and doing shots of, I don't know, whiskey.
Yeah.
So they come back at some point.
Champagne?
People said they saw them around 10 p.m. and they were wearing 3-piece suits and sunglasses.
Oh, trying to be like mobsters.
Who knows, but some speculated that maybe they dressed in such a way to really, really establish an alibi by drawing attention to themselves. Hmm. That they wanted to be sure that they were placed at the Backdoor Bar at that time.
Okay.
So Marty and Marilyn had been together since 1979, a couple years before this happened. They had also attended a typing class with Sue. Their cabin was situated across a narrow street from the Sharps' cabin. When police spoke with Marilyn, she told them that she and Marty just happened to separate the day after the murders. So they would have separated, I believe, on either April 12th or 13th. So just very odd timing of when this all happened.
Yeah.
She described Marty as very short-tempered. He was violent and abusive. Marty Smart told the police that he had a hammer that matched the one found at the crime scene, which had gone missing shortly before the murders.
Okay.
Later that year, a knife was also recovered from a garbage bin outside the Keddie General Store. Authorities do believe that this was linked to the crime. After police interviewed Marty and Beau, Marty was given a polygraph test, and investigators decided that they had not been involved in the murders, and they simply allowed them to go. When police spoke with Marilyn at a later time, she added that Marty hated John Sharp, the 15-year-old. They didn't say why. What adult man in his 30s hates a 15-year-old?
I mean, 15-year-olds can be annoying, but yeah, if you're spending your time on hating a teenager, you got, you know, probably bigger fish to fry, yeah, I would think.
I would say so. Yeah. We had teenagers across the pond from where we live, and at one point in time, they put garbage bags down and were slip and sliding into the pond, which is like not a pond you swim in.
No, anything in Florida has amoebas that are brain eating. So it's like,
you generally don't want to do that.
Yeah.
So obviously I rolled my eyes and I'm like, jackass teenagers. I wouldn't hate them.
Right.
You don't spend time hating a teenager is what I could say.
Right.
So regardless, he hated John Sharp. And in the early morning hours of the murder, Marilyn just so happened to see Marty burning something in their fireplace. Mm. And keep in mind that whoever did this horrific murders was covered in blood. So was this bloody clothing that he was burning.
Decent chance.
So Marty had his one and only interview with police one day after the discovery of the murders, which was on April 13th, your birthday.
Yep.
The next day, he left the area for Reno and later moved to Klamath Falls, Oregon. Beau left Keddie shortly after the murders. He returned to Chicago, where he was from.
Boy, I wonder why.
So they were very easily let go.
Mm-hmm.
As police continued their investigation, there was still no sign of Tina. Her disappearance was initially investigated by the FBI as a possible abduction, but on April 29th, 1981, the FBI had backed off the search as the California State Department of Justice was said to be doing an adequate job, which made the FBI's presence unnecessary. They used a grid pattern search of the area covering a 5-mile area, and 3 years would pass before anyone had any idea what happened to 12-year-old Tina. So now we're moving forward to April 22nd, 1984, a little more than 3 years after the murders. A man named Ronald Pedrini was collecting bottles in the woods 90 miles southwest of Keddie when he discovered a human skull and part of a jawbone at Camp 18 near Feather Falls in neighboring Butte County. Nearby was a child's blanket, a blue nylon jacket, a pair of jeans that had a missing back pocket, and an empty surgical tape dispenser. Now, keep in mind, when Justin was under hypnosis, he did say that a man came back and grabbed Tina's blankets. Mm-hmm. They did find a blanket by this skull and jawbone.
Mm-hmm.
So a few months later, in June of 1984, a forensic pathologist determined that the remains did belong to Tina Sharp, which now increased the murders from a triple homicide to a quadruple homicide. Just so sad.
Super sad.
Meanwhile, Sheriff Thomas resigned from the investigation 3 months in. He transferred to a position to Sacramento. To many, his handling of the case was considered disastrous at best and corrupt at worst.
Oh, corrupt, but it's really, really bad.
And now we're really skipping ahead.
Is he friends with Marty? Or?
Oh, yes.
Oh, my God. This is going to make me so mad.
He's tight with Marty.
Son of a biscuit.
So in 2010, Greg Hagwood became the sheriff. And in June of 2013, he brought special investigator Mike Gamberg back from retirement to sort through this boundless boxes of evidence in order to help revive the case. Much of the physical evidence that was taken from Cabin 28 is still in storage. It includes the living room carpet, wallboard, and other items marked with blood. However, the original case history log is long gone, which is making the case particularly difficult to organize.
Yeah, I wonder what happened.
Some of the evidence has been contaminated. Some was placed in a freezer for preservation, but then the freezer was turned off, so nothing was preserved. As Gamberg, went through the evidence, he found a sealed envelope at the bottom of an evidence box. And inside, he found a tape with a recording. It turned out that shortly after announcing the discovery of the remains that were found in November of 1984, the Butte County Sheriff's Office received an anonymous phone call that suggested that the remains belonged to Tina. The caller said, "I was wondering if they thought of the murder up in Keddy, up in Plumas County, a couple of years ago where the 12-year-old girl was never found." Investigators hearing this evidence now in 2013 believe that the call was not at all random, since Tina's body was found in an exceptionally remote area. It was unrelated to Keddy. It was like 90 miles away.
Yeah.
It was 3 years afterwards. So people,
like, who the hell would think of
who
that?
Who would think of that?
Outside of the murderer.
Right. And they even thought it was strange that this man was collecting bottles in an area that they're like, it's not even on the map.
Yeah.
They said, when we say remote, when we're looking for this area, knowing where it is, it's hard to find.
Mm.
Who's looking for bottles and cans in a remote area?
I mean, I thought that was weird. Yeah, there's probably way more bottles and cans in a non-remote area.
So according to Google Maps, it is a 65-mile drive from Keddy. It would take approximately 2 hours and 15 minutes. So why would this caller be suggesting Tina Sharp? Did they want to, you know...
He found out and go back in the news.
And was also this other guy, was he hunting for bottles? Like, was somebody telling him to look there?
Right.
So very suspicious. The tape had never been admitted into evidence, despite the fact that the medical examiner had yet to confirm that the remains did belong to Tina, because we know it took months.
Yeah.
So it seemed very interesting that nothing was done based on this phone call. So it was Gamberg's belief that the caller was told what happened or had been somehow involved in the murders. The tape was then turned over for voice comparisons with audio of earlier suspects to see if it was somebody that was related to the case that made this phone call. So the murders felt personal to the team in 2013 that were helping to revive the case. Sheriff Hagwood was 16 years old at the time of the murders. He actually went to school with both Johnny and Dana. And then the summer before their murders, they had all worked together as teenagers on a painting crew. So obviously, this case is near and dear to him, and he wants to solve it, even though so many years have passed. His mother had also been Tina's teacher. Prior to the Sharp family moving into Keddy Cabin 28, Hagwood had been friends with a previous owner. He stayed there dozens of times. Investigator Mike Gamberg also knew Dana and Johnny. He was their martial arts instructor. Dana had actually been at Gamberg's house just the day before he was murdered. In 2016, 35 years after the murders, a man had been in the area for a wedding. He was using a metal detector to help a woman who said she had lost a ring. So this was when he happened to stumble upon a hammer that he dug up from the dried up pond near the Keddy Resort entrance. Based on the appearance of the hammer, it was very clear that that hammer had been at the location for a prolonged period of time. It was an exact match for the steel blue-handled claw hammer that Marty told investigators just happened to go missing from his cabin right before these murders. So it was tested for trace DNA and blood residue and had likely been tossed into the pond by someone that was leaving the murder scene. The results of this DNA has yet to be reported as to what came back on this just yet.
Oh, that sucks.
In 2016, Sheila spoke with CBS Sacramento. She said that she was told that the suspects were instructed to get out of town, which made her believe that there had absolutely been a cover-up.
Who was telling them to get out of town?
I assume one
Sheila
of the
doesn't know?
The sheriffs that was handling the case.
Like, who'd she hear that from?
I don't know. She was told by somebody.
Oh, okay.
So by that time in 2016, Martin Smart and Bo were already deceased. Bo died in 1988. Marty died in 2006. They both had criminal records. They were a stone's throw away from Cabin 28 on the night of the murders. In addition to Marilyn Smart leaving Marty on the very day that the murders were discovered, she later provided Plumas County Sheriff's Department with a handwritten letter that was sent to her and signed by her estranged husband, Marty. I actually read this letter, and in the very end of the letter, he writes, "I have paid the price for your love, and now I've bought it with four people's lives. You tell me we're through. Great. What else do you want?" So he said he paid the price or bought the price or whatever with four people's lives.
Whatever that means.
Well, four people were dead.
Right. But like, what do you mean paid the price? Like, did she want them dead?
Well, I'll tell you more about that too.
Oh, good.
Investigators didn't view the letter as a confession, nor was it followed up on at the time. Because, of course, we know that Marty left town pretty much right afterwards.
Wait, what year was it when he sent that?
Like shortly thereafter the murders.
It wasn't considered...
No.
In what world is that not considered evidence?
It wasn't. Like, okay. They were like, no, that's fine.
Yeah, Sheriff Doug Thomas. I'm Sheriff Doug Thomas. I don't consider this evidence. No. Next case, please.
You go on your way.
Yeah.
So in 2008, there was a documentary where Marilyn was interviewed, and she admitted that she thought that her husband and Beau were responsible for the murders. However, Sheriff Doug Thomas contradicted this. He pointed out that Marty passed his polygraph, so he was good to go. In 2016, investigator Mike Gamberg, and this is interesting, he met with a counselor at the Reno Veterans Administration, and this anonymous counselor had, you know, worked with Marty in May of 1981, a month after the murders. Marty Smart had confessed to killing Sue and Tina Sharp. He told this counselor, "I killed the woman and her daughter, but I did not have anything to do with the boys." This confession came during Marty's seventh appointment with this counselor, and he may have been under the impression that because he was speaking with a mental health counselor, that this person would be under oath to keep what he was saying confidential.
Yeah, doctor-client privilege or whatever.
However, because this information related to murder, the law allows a counselor to divulge this information. The counselor indicated that when Marty was discussing the murder of Sue, he had an unemotional, flat affect. When he discussed Tina, he was asked why she hadn't run away, and Marty said that he incapacitated her. When asked why he had done this, Marty said that he was convinced that Sue was the reason why Marilyn wanted to divorce him, and Tina just happened to be an innocent witness. The counselor told Marty that he needed to turn himself in, and Marty only smiled at his advice. During his confession, he referenced his polygraph test and said, "I beat it. Those things are easy to beat. I was lying and they let me go." When the counselor alerted the Department of Justice of this information, they brushed it off as hearsay. So Marty confessed to murdering Sue and Tina, and they brushed it off as hearsay.
I mean, I don't know
how nothing was done.
I don't know how hearsay is defined, but I mean, yeah, it is hearsay. The counselor heard Marty say that he murdered, you know, at least two people. So, Sue and Tina.
So, again, that was a month after the murders.
And how do you brush it off? Like how? And this was the Department of Justice. So this wasn't just the local police department.
So this counselor contacted the Department of Justice to let them know what Marty said during their seventh counseling session. And it was just hearsay. Nothing to see here. Nothing to do here. Hmm. So in 2018, investigators were able to analyze DNA from a strip of white medical tape that had been found on the floor near Sue's body. The DNA did come back as a match. However, it's to an unknown living suspect is what is said.
Living
is what they said. So if they're unknown, how do we know they're living?
Right.
It's very confusing to me.
Maybe like undisclosed living.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Gamberg indicated that he's had the DNA for several years, but only recently obtained needed samples and found the match. Until then, lack of fingerprints and identifiable DNA left at the scene by the killer or killers has halted investigative efforts. The perpetrators wore gloves and left none of their own blood behind, which indicated that they were not injured during this blitz attack that happened in the cabin. The killers brought one hammer. This is likely the one from Marty's cabin that was found in the pond in 2016. They also used tools from the home, which included a hammer and some of the knives. Medical tape they did bring with them. The medical tape did not come from the Sharp cabin, but nor did the BB gun that they saw the imprint on Sue. But a lot of the tools and things they used for the crime came from the Sharp's cabin. The wiring that they were tied up with.
Yeah, it looks like they just came in and they were like, okay, what can we use here? Let's use some of this wire and whatever and this and that.
So they did bring a hammer and medical tape. So you would assume they did enter the cabin that night with the intention of bad things happening.
Yeah.
So it's been theorized that there was a love triangle between Marty, Marilyn, and Sue. And there's been conversation that Marty and Sue were potentially having an affair. And then again, we know that some say that Sue had been urging Marilyn to leave Marty because
she wanted Marty.
Well,
perhaps
because I guess more so because he was abusive towards her, which makes me think, was Sue really having an affair with this abusive man? I don't know.
Well, a lot of times abused women and men go for abusive people. You know, that's the kind of people they are sometimes. Not that it's their fault whatsoever, but they, you know, it's like you look at certain people and it's like, why do you keep going back to that person?
True. So then, of course, Marty would have discovered that Sue was urging Marilyn to leave him, and this could have been the motive for the murder. And then he could have asked his friend Beau, who just so happened to be staying on his couch and had come to their cabin 10 days before, to help him with the murder in order to remove Sue from the picture. So this would explain why Marilyn left Marty on the very day that the murders were discovered, as well as why as the three boys were there and were unharmed, because Justin was there. Justin was Marty's stepson.
Yeah.
He wasn't going to hurt Marilyn's son. But why would he choose the night that Justin was there having a sleepover? That was my thought.
Probably different, better nights to do that.
You would think. But then you don't know. Were they at the backdoor bar? They got drunk, and then made this decision?
Tonight's the night, buddy boy. We're doing it.
Yeah. This would also explain Marty's handwritten note that Marilyn gave the Plumas Sheriff's Department. Investigator Mike Gamberg speculates that the Department of Justice and a Thomas-run sheriff's department covered it up and alleges that Marty and Beau were involved in a larger drug smuggling scheme that involved the federal government. Marty was a known drug dealer, and Beau was connected to Chicago crime syndicates. Syndicates? Am I saying syndicates?
Yeah.
Okay, I don't know why that sounded weird in my ears. With financial interests in drug distribution. So he thinks like all of this could have been just a big cover-up. It could also explain why the Sacramento DOJ sent two allegedly corrupt organized crime special agents instead of agents from the homicide departments.
Yeah, that would make more sense.
Yeah, and why two main suspects were apparently given a free pass to leave town by Sheriff Thomas. It would also explain why the case was handled so sloppily, why it remains unsolved to this day, and was seemingly not a priority to the Sacramento DOJ. Marty and Sheriff Doug Thomas were really tight. Thomas had even lived in Cabin 28 before the Sharp's arrival. Marty had even allegedly stayed with Thomas in Cabin 28 when he and Marilyn were having marital issues. Marty would oftentimes go out on patrol with Thomas while he was out working. They would just hang out in the patrol car together.
Did they ever go to the backdoor bar together?
I do not know that.
I think maybe they made their own backdoor bar.
They could have. I don't know. So regardless, you know, they were good friends. So that would be reason for Thomas to just let Marty have a pass.
Tell me, Sheriff Doug Thomas is dead.
Well, I actually don't know that answer.
Okay.
I don't know. So the theory is that after Marty and Beau left the bar that Saturday night, they changed out of their three-piece suits and into jeans and denim jackets. They likely walked from Cabin 26 to Cabin 28 by Keddy Resort Road before entering the home and killing their four victims. While under hypnosis, Justin said that he saw two men wearing jeans and jean jackets. That's where they came that they changed. After they subdued Sue, perhaps they then went back to the bar in their suits, which would have given them an alibi. Gamberg believes that they never did change. He thinks that Justin was wrong on saying that he saw two men wearing denim. So he thinks they were never actually wearing the denim. When Dana and John arrived, the murderers were probably already with Sue. Sue was likely the last victim alive. They think that she was forced to witness the murder happening around her, which included two of her children. Tina's body would have been driven away, and the one road that does lead to Keddie, this is exceptionally dark at night, it could have been very easy to do so. A neighbor reported hearing this muffled scream. It was about 1:30 in the morning. This could have come from Tina when she was killed. Gamberg believes that she was then likely stashed into a nearby car and later driven away. No roadblocks were ever established, despite the fact that it was one single road that the killer would have taken in and out of Keddie. But again, they didn't even notice that Tina was missing for hours until after she was, you know, they were assessing the crime scene. So they never established a roadblock. They never searched any vehicles. Others believe that Tina was murdered inside the house because there was blood evidence in the room that she shared with her mom towards the back of the cabin. So, you know, this is all guess. Blood spatter was discovered in this room, including on both of the beds. When Marilyn saw Marty burning unknown items in the wood stove at about 2 a.m., it's believed that he was burning the bloody clothing that they wore that night. There is a slight time discrepancy, as Marty told investigators that he left the bar before 2 a.m., and an unnamed person who gave John and Dana a ride that night said that they were dropped off at cabin 28 between 10 and 11 p.m. So they actually found the person that John and Dana hitchhiked back with. It was a female. She was questioned. She said that the boys went to the front door rather than around the back to go to John's bedroom. The driver said that there was no outside light on the cabin, but they could see light coming from inside the cabin. She just left and drove off. It's believed that Dana and John went through the front door and then back down the back steps to John's bedroom, and then they heard a noise. They likely ran up the back stairs to investigate, but this, again, is only theory. John's room appears to have never been processed by law enforcement, which I found very strange because it's on the property.
And he's one of the victims.
Right. Dana was diabetic and would have likely left his insulin as well as other items behind because he was staying the night in John's room. They never looked to see if they came back to the bedroom and then went back up to the main house. So regardless, the boys would have walked into a nightmare. John likely rushed to defend his mother, who was being brutalized by Marty. Beau then apprehended Dana, who appeared to have tried to flee the room and was struck in the head from behind with a hammer or a pellet rifle. We do know that neither boy had defensive wounds on their body, so whatever happened to them likely happened very quickly. The killers were likely in cabin 28 for some time. Just based on the evidence in the cabin, it was not quick. The fact that they were all tied up and this and that.
Sure.
That much of the time they believe was spent torturing Sue. They think that she was the ultimate victim. John and Dana just happened upon the scene, as did Tina. Mm. And of course, we know that when Justin was under hypnosis, he did say that Tina came to the door when she heard a noise. And also the confession from that counselor at the Reno Veterans Administration said that the reason why Marty killed Tina was because she witnessed what happened. So that all kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
Based on the blood found in the bottoms of Sue's feet, as well as the few bloody footprints that came from Sue in the living room, they may have forced her to walk around and see what she allegedly made them do. And I mean, how can you hurt a mother more than hurting her own children? I would sacrifice my life any day over my children's.
Of course.
So there would have been no way to punish her more than hurting her own children. So they had likely fled cabin 28 before 4 a.m. since Marty would have known that the railroad crew would be starting their shift. We also know that Marilyn said she saw Marty burning things at 2 a.m. So likely things happen somewhere around 1:30 when they heard that scream, that muffled scream. Hagwood and Gamberg believe that as many as six people could have been involved in the entirety of the crime, not necessarily the murder, but the entirety of the crime that includes the murders, the disposal of the evidence, and the abduction of Tina.
Like, people
helped people.
That's a lot.
And you got to wonder, too, because they did aerial shots of the location on the morning of the murders when they found the bodies. And you could see various cars parked around, but of course, no cars were ever searched. Was Tina's body still in one of the cars and had yet to be driven away? Had they looked at the vehicles?
A good chance.
And it's kind of crazy to me that none of the vehicles were searched or roadblocks were established when there was a 12-year-old girl that was abducted.
Yeah.
I find that just bizarre.
And the FBI was involved right away, right?
They, well, I mean, we're talking
probably, took them a day to fly
probably
in.
Some time, because a handful of hours before they even realized Tina was missing, which then prompted the FBI when they got there, I'm not entirely clear.
Yeah.
But, you know, who knows? They could have found Tina's body in one of the cars.
Right.
So again, they do feel like there are a handful of people that are still alive to this day, despite the fact that Martin Smart and Bobaday, yes, are now deceased. New DNA evidence has guided investigators to other suspects who may have been involved and are still alive. Every bit of evidence that remains is important to this case, and Gamber continues his search for leads and is re-interviewing anyone linked to the Keddie murders. In recent interviews, both Hagwood and Gamberg said that they feel that the sheriff's office, as well as the California Department of Justice, handled the case very poorly in 1981. Leads were not followed, evidence was not properly checked, or had been ignored altogether. Some individuals that had the capability of handling the crime scene and the case were not allowed to do their jobs in 1981. They were wanting to put certain people on the case. Like, I think Mike Gamberg was not allowed to be on the case. He was working at that point.
He's too good of a cop.
Yeah. So new evidence that Hagwood and Gamberg have come across, have given them solid leads. They are not willing to divulge the specifics on whom they are watching, but they are watching certain people.
Interesting.
They believe that there are local people who know more than what they have said. Again, this is a very small town, and with small towns come secrets being buried with them. You know, they'll take it to the grave.
Yeah.
They have been able to identify some of them and know where they are. According to Hagwood, there is not an expiration date on homicides. And to the extent that we have surviving siblings and family members, it is our fundamental obligation to them to understand who did this and why, no matter how much time has passed. The cabins within Keddie Resort, including Cabin 28, have slowly deteriorated as the years have gone by and as the years went by and have eventually been condemned. The Sharps' home of Cabin 28 was demolished in 2004. A lot of people like to go and visit places where terrible crimes and murders have taken place.
Not me.
It's like this morbid fascination.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of people were breaking into Cabin 28. Some people were trying to spend the night. There was a lot of squatting happening, so they did demolish it in 2004.
Good.
Cabin 26, where Marilyn and Marty lived, still stands. I watched a video on YouTube. This girl drove through the resorts. She was able to walk through some of the cabins.
No doubt.
So in 2017, a horror film that was inspired by the murders was released by a UK production company. It's simply called Cabin 28. As of 2016, Sheila was a 50-year-old mother of three, a grandmother of two. She has purposely pushed the horrific images of what has now been 43 years ago out of her mind. She chooses to remember the happy times. After finding the horrific scene, she held out hope that she would still be reunited with her missing little sister. Of course, that didn't happen, and then she was devastated all over again when Tina's remains were discovered. Sheila, Greg, and Rick were sent out of state to live with an aunt, but because this aunt already had several kids, they were eventually placed, sadly, in foster care. Initially, they were together. They were later separated. In 2012, Sheila and her husband wrote a book, How to Survive Your Visit to Earth. It's a self-help book that also describes, you know, what happened in this case and how she dealt with what has happened. She remains hopeful that despite the time that has passed, this case will ultimately be solved. Anyone who has any information on the Keddie murders is asked to call the Keddie murders hotline at 530-283-6360. And this is a story of the Keddie cabin murders that happened 43 years ago and remains unsolved.
That's crazy. I was just looking up to see if Doug Thomas, Sheriff Doug Thomas, is still alive. It looks like he probably is. Like you said, there's like tons of different things you can read about this.
Oh, this case is, oh my gosh. I was so immersed in this case. I was eating, breathing, dreaming it.
Yeah.
And you can get yourself down these rabbit holes. There's so many theories of what could have happened. But, you know, he basically left that office 3 months after the murders. Yeah. But by that time, so much had been passed up. You know, Marty and Bo had already left town. But I mean, I definitely believe they were the two that had to have been the murderers.
Yeah.
Why would Marty tell his counselor that he did what he did to Tina and Sue?
If that evidence is true, if that actually exists, then absolutely, he's a murderer.
And what he wrote in that letter to Marilyn, to me, was pretty damning.
And the only thing is if she didn't provide the actual letter, then it is hearsay.
Oh, yeah, she gave the letter. I saw the letter.
If the letter exists, then that's pretty much a...
The letter exists. Yeah. And they did like the handwriting analysis to prove that it was his.
Like I just read something here that Sheriff Thomas fired Mike Gamberg. Like,
yeah, Mike Gamberg was fired multiple times, like three times.
He was probably getting like smart onto it.
100%.
Sheriff Thomas, man, if you listen to this, I would love to hear your side of the story. And like I consider you a piece of garbage, so I would love to hear why you're not a piece of garbage and how you let a lie detector test determine whether or not this guy is ready to go.
So that's why I think Mike Gamberg is so set on helping solve this case, even though so many years have gone by, because it was so personal to him. He knew the victims. Like I said, Dana was at his house the day before. He was working for the department at that time. He was not allowed to do his job. So like you just said, if Sheriff Thomas was, getting a whiff that somebody was pursuing actual evidence that was going to lead to an arrest, he wanted you gone. That's what it sounded like to me. So very corrupt, very dirty. And that sadly has left these four victims not have a name pinned to who did this to them. And, Sheila is wanting answers, and Rick and Greg, they all want answers.
I mean, just pin it on freaking Marty. Like that's a low hanging fruit right there.
And then, the fact that his hammer that he said was missing was clearly thrown in that pond on the way out. Who knows if it was on the way to drive with Tina's body. It's just so sad.
It's horrible. A little better police work would have gotten something figured out.
Totally.
Faster. Well, thank you for telling that story. It's horrible. So thank you so much for everybody for listening. We really appreciate you. If you appreciate what we do, we'd appreciate it if you could head on over to Patreon or Apple subscriptions. And like I said, throw us a couple shekels. Maybe you subscribe for a month or two. See how it is. You get a bonus episode every week if you're an Apple, and Patreon, you get to choose every other week or not. So come on over. Well, I want to say welcome to the latest members of the Crime and Coffee Couple Club, to Kendra and Shannon. Thank you so much. We really appreciate you. Welcome to the club. And hey, everybody, tell your friends, family members, coworkers about the Crime and Coffee Couple.
Absolutely.
And again, go subscribe to us on YouTube. If you listen to this whole thing, definitely subscribe. I think it's right down there.
So. And we do have like probably upwards of 60 bonus episodes available. So if you want to become a patron or Apple subscriber, you can binge and listen to a bunch.
Go get it.
Absolutely.
Oh, and I used to tell more stories in the beginning. We had a couple people ask if I'll be telling more stories. Allison would love that. Maybe I will. Who knows?
Yeah, just here and there. Throw, a little curveball.
Yeah.
Who knows? A new set of words coming out of their mouths, because Lord knows I have a hard time talking sometimes.
Yeah, you say it all the time. It's easy for you to say.
Easy for me to say. Well, we appreciate you guys so much for being here. Thank you. And until next time.